Session number 9963.
Mr. Brewer, Regal 6.
So Lord Harding was dependent then on the accounts given him by some of the officers over there. And he was trying to recollect what had happened. So it's the eyewitness who was near enough to see what happens, who was able to correct the impressions. Well, there's a big argument about how Nathan died. And that was my version of it, that I saw a commotion. Because I was sitting down then, and I simply lay down and hoped that the bomb fragments would fly harmlessly overhead, which they did. But he got it, and that was what was the end of him. Well, in these various battles, you get all sorts of accounts about individuals, and you only rely in the main on what you've seen yourself, because the people have got all sorts of motives for what they say and do afterwards. And we've got a classic example in South Wales of a chap from down the valley whose service in the war against fascism amounted to 27 days of frontline service. The Battle of Brunette he won, which from which he was saved by a Welshman, Tom Evans of Cefn Cribwr, who brought him out. He would never have made it on his own because he was shattered and exhausted, and Tom had to bring himself out, his section of infantry and this commissar, who became a very quiet man after that. And after Brunetti, he was promoted to be commissar of the battalion. So he had to go forward under fire now, with the side by side with the commander, who happened to be an Irishman and a damn good soldier. And the Irishman got killed, and this chap, the commissar, he survived it. He had a slight wound, and he went back to the rear to convalesce eventually at Benicassim on the shores of the Mediterranean. And the next thing we knew was that he had gone home. In the meantime now, the surviving Welshmen went on and on into battle after battle, and we got whittled down. Well, this chap was back, and of course he went around parading his great services in this great war. And he's even had a book written about him, which is a mishmash of fancy and a minimum of fact. And the attempt was made to turn him into a hero, because he'd become a communist county, a communist district councillor, and so on. And a number of us know precisely how good he was and how much he faced up to. But of course he got home long before us, you see, and he was able to wander about. And his grandson wrote a book about him, which is a mishmash of myth and imagination. And this man was always silent in our company in reunions, because we knew, and he couldn't put anything over on us. Because after he left, too many good men gave their lives, and we remember them, and we compare and contrast, and we had no time for him.
You were saying earlier about the political issue and how you thought there was too much of it, but was there any discussion amongst the ranks of the International Brigaders of this issue which keeps coming up by left-wing people nowadays, of revolution or victory? How some left-wing people say that the revolution in Spain should have been pushed forward, and that was the reason why the war was lost. Did you ever discuss that issue?
Well, we put it down to a number of factors. One, that you didn't have an industrial proletariat in Spain. That such a huge number of them were simply lads who had come from the fields, who had no industrial, they hadn't tasted industrial organization and discipline. They were uneducated, so many of them were illiterate, and a lot of our chaps got busy teaching them to read Spanish, although they couldn't speak Spanish themselves. But they, a lot of the Spaniards learned to read in consequence of association with our chaps. Now, when you go into it with any depth at all, you realize that the parties in Spain were more pronounced on the left, were more pronounced in their individuality than anything we had in this country. Now, you had the anarchists who didn't believe in all this discipline, and their idea was to go out and fight and go back home at night. But they were brave men, and they had this fundamental weakness that they believed in the goodness of man, and that all this organization and discipline wasn't necessary. It was a philosophical concept which was quite harmful to them in the end. Well, then you had people who were sort of moderate socialists, and you had all sorts of groupings. They hadn't had time to form anything as cohesive as the, say, the 1945 Labour government, which seized the reins of power and really got on to carry out the policies upon which they'd been elected. And then you had too many Don Quixotes, you see, and an insufficient number of Sancho Panza, the practical man. The chaps with their heads in the clouds, preaching, advancing their ideas, arguing, at cross purpose with one another. Each one knew what was best for the country and so on.
Did you personally come across much of Spanish politics?
Very little. Very little. We had about 50% of Spaniards in our anti-tank battery, and we just listened to the pundits. We reacted in our various ways, but we were just good friends, and they were concerned to preserve the Republic and to do their little bit for it, just as we were. That was the fundamental thing. But above us, there were all these damn conflicts, political conflicts going on. You didn't have a government which was united and put politics on one side and get on with winning the war. So it was a very, very complex situation about which we knew nothing. And the Communist Party did very good work in sort of organizing, getting things going, but they overstepped the mark.
In what way?
Well, there was too much of it. Too much preaching. They were going to take over the country. Well, the Spaniards weren't ready for that. And it was a luxury. I mean, we were short of arms, short of vehicles, short of all essential military equipment. And we just had to do the best we could with what we had.
Did you get any VIP visits in Spain? Any important people who came to visit you?
Well, Pandit Nehru came along on one occasion. And there was a lot of preparation for that. Like the Duke of York, the commanders are marching there, the number one company, the battalion, up the hill and down again. And we were out at rest at the time, reorganising, getting reinforcements and so on. And I remember one occasion when Sam Wilde, he was in a bad temper for some reason that particular afternoon. He blew the whistle and the battalion stood too. And he got up on a little bit of a hillock and he started addressing us in terms that the officers in the British Navy might address the lower orders. And now, of course, his language wasn't too choice. And he made one remark. Now, every man had his rifle and you had the slings, you see, fastened to metal clips. And right, you could feel it going right through the battalion, shaking as a signal of anger. They shook their rifles, we all shook our rifles, and this clip at each end of the sling was rattling against the metal or the stock of the rifle.
What were you protesting against?
His language and his attitude to us, because we were volunteers and we weren't going to be talked to as if we were a bunch of raw conscript. And one or two chaps in the background had managed to slip the bolts, and in the silence those bolts going home were a hell of a warning. And I think there were men there who, if Sam had kept on, there were men there who would have turned their rifles on him and shot him, because we just weren't going to have it. We'd been through too much to be talked to by anyone.
What was he so annoyed about?
That we hadn't turned out quickly enough and smartly enough on the parade. He forgot the circumstances. It was in the afternoon and we were at rest and we were having a siesta. So he was sensible enough to realise that he'd overstepped the mark, and he modified his comments then. And of course Nauru came along and various high potentates with him and reviewed the troops.
When would that have been approximately?
Now, it's very difficult for me to say. I can remember the location, but I would have to look up reference for the dates.
Where was the location?
I think it was when we were starting on the Ebro, myself. But you can look that up in any one of the histories to get the date for that. Then we had Paul Robeson came out there on one occasion. I never saw him, but he gave a concert somewhere. And Irene Bevan came out. And I had known an Irene quite intimately in my during the Hunger March period and earlier. And I'd written him a few letters from Spain and got a few replies, but I don't remember him ever coming to the battalion, or to meet any of his fellow countrymen or his constituents, because there were about five of us who went from the Abbeville constituency out there. And then we had a visit at Teruel in Christmas of 37. I was on guard at the cookhouse where the big cauldron was simmering away, making a Christmas dinner. And my relief turned up and we saw some movement to our right, and two very well-fed figures loomed up, picking their way gingerly over the debris. And it was rather incongruous, because one was very tall and very big and the other was shorter and squat. And it struck me, you know, these chaps picking their way gingerly over the fallen masonry, and I said to my relief, "Good God, Mutt and Jeff, the two famous comic characters that we'd been brought up on." And he looked and he laughed. And I discovered subsequently it was Hemingway and J.S. Haldane who were going to visit the battalion. And I think that was about the all that we saw of the notabilities until the our last parades in Barcelona and various Catalonian towns.
What impression did these VIPs make on you, like Nero and Hemingway?
Well, nothing, really. Hemingway made no impression on me. I thought, well, he is a big, tough guy. They could do with more soldiers in the Lincoln Washington Battalion. He could have joined up and proved his mettle on the field of battle. But he didn't. And I notice in his letters, I saw some book of his, published letters of Ernest Hemingway, where he castigates the British for retreating at Jarama and does them down pretty thoroughly in this letter. He must have had a lot of animus against us for some reason. And he then wrote about his experiences with the Maquis in France, where he'd been out drinking with these chaps who suddenly came out of the woodwork. They all claimed to be resistance fighters. And the great Hemingway, of course, now he was going to lead them to take over this hamlet where they were reputed to be German troops. And I can imagine that all of them were half sloshed in a warm southern French afternoon after they'd been in the cafe for some hours. And so they set out with Hemingway at the head now. He was the great hero. And he confesses that, and as to fighting, chicken shit. The Germans had gone. And that was his involvement there. See, you could do the pen, but the actions didn't match it. He had so many opportunities there to make a great reputation. He might have got killed, of course. But I'd always had the impression that there were two sides to the man. There was a good writer and the indifferent performer. And of course that dichotomy finished him off in the end. That he just he couldn't cope with the two parts of his being.
Coming back to Spain, can we pick up the narrative of, because we stopped at the end of the Battle of Brunete.
Yeah.
And can you tell me what happened to you personally after that?
Well, we still had our guns, you see, and so we went and we were stationed in what had been an old mill, bit of a wrecked building, empty. So we commandeered that now, and Miles Tomlin was a great friend of mine. And we set to then. We got a table going and chairs. We had a bottle of wine and we set out to write the, put up the wall newspaper, which was called Assault and Battery News. And I always had a column in it, and because Miles came to the conclusion there were a hell of a lot of things I didn't like, and I wasn't averse to showing it. So my first contribution was Things I Don't Like. And I was allowed a certain amount of license. So we used to put this paper up now with all these various articles, the contributions from the lads, and they used to come from far and near to have a look at this. Any of the chaps who knew where we were, we had friends in the American battalion, in the infantry, the British battalion. So there'd be a lot of fraternization. And we were getting regular food, and we'd go to to various local cafes and sit down and spend the evening with a bottle of wine and conversing. And then we got to, we did quite a bit of travelling subsequently as a sort of army reserve, moving up and down. And I think our next engagement was was at Teruel, where we went into the field up in the hills around Teruel in a blizzard, and we got lost. And Dunbar showed his qualities as a commander then, that we'd pause and we'd unload the guns and the ammunition while he went to do a bit of scouting around as far as he could. Then he'd come back and load up. We found a barn we can go to, and then we'd fail to find it. And eventually we did find a big barn and unloaded our guns, took them inside, and sheltered the trucks with the ammunition on, and we just flung ourselves down on the straw and had a reasonable night's sleep. And then we went into position, a backup position in the line. And there was one of the experiences there now was to be lying out, sleeping in the slit trench with about 3 foot of snow and the damp earth. And the only thing that saved me there was the fact that I was the only one on the gun team who could cope with cognac in the morning. So we'd have a slice of bread, toasted, smeared over with olive oil, and rubbing in a clove of garlic on top of it, and the ration used to come up. And I'd get, they couldn't stomach it, the lads. So I'd get a glass, about, what, almost half pint glass of cognac, and the ersatz coffee made out of barley beans. And when I drank that, I was able to straighten up, because otherwise I was like that. The cold had got into my spine. And I didn't realise it, but one morning I must have been feverish. I wasn't aware of anything. To me, I seemed quite normal. Got this cognac down. And the boys got me whipped off to a hospital. And I was on the verge of pneumonia. But there was this most unhospital-like hospital. It was in a building, beds side by side, wounded, sick men. And the only thing was that there were plenty of blankets, so we were warm, and the doctors gave what treatment they could. And one told me that I was damn lucky that they brought me in when they did. But if I'd been up there for another 3 or 4 hours, I'd have been in pneumonia, and my chances of surviving wouldn't have been very good. But now, of course, I should have been sent back then to convalesce. But they weren't doing that. If you could stand up, back into the line. But they did make a reservation. They gave a letter to the battery commander to say that under no circumstances was I to be allowed for a couple of weeks, allowed to sleep out, that I should be found employment at the cookhouse, and at all times to be sure that I was warm. Well, the cookhouse was in a very nice, adjacent to a very nice house, and that saved the issue. But any man who could, the pressure was so great there, and they were anticipating the counterattack. The weather was so bad and so on, that men were sent back into the line who should never have been sent. They should have gone back to the rear. And the I remember one of the days now, subsequently, after about a fortnight, I went back to the guns. And I remember sitting there now, looking around the snowy landscape. And it was a morning like this, perfectly clear. And out came the German and Italian air forces. And it was like an air show at Hendon. Wherever you looked, there were squadrons of bombers or squadrons of flying above fighters. The whole damn sky was full of them. And at one particular point, the bombers went in now on this crest, and when the bombs had exploded, when they were rolling down the hill at this position, but it looked as if there was a dam up there and it had burst and the foaming water was coming out. It was really dreadful, concentrated bombing. And I thought, well, even if those men are well dug in, I can't see that they could cope with this, because it was really heavy, continuous bombing on a very small area. And of course they broke the line, because they were using our concentrated artillery fire on top of this, you see. Well, I mean, we just didn't have the equipment to cope with it. And the men had suffered privation and cold and all the rest of it. And they had all their tanks, their artillery and all the rest of it, and they broke the line. And we had to surrender terry well. And there were some pretty violent engagements. As far as British battalion were concerned, they took a hell of a pasting there, because they were being driven back over open country by all this weight of material. And I think that was one of the finest displays of aerial power that I had seen up to date. They really were perfecting their tactics. Now, I think subsequent to that, we went up to take Gandesa. And we got involved in fighting around Ica. We started off in the morning with a field of fire of about 200 degrees. In the course of the day, we had swung right around from supporting the Dombrowski, the Polish battalion of the 15th, right around now to supporting our own chaps who had to take this Perbello Hill, which was well fortified.